Blog Talk Radio.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by CounterRacism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's Counter-Racism.com.
Greetings. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to another episode of The Cow's Context of White Supremacy. This is Gus T. Renegade. First, I want to take the opportunity to thank everybody for tuning in to the programs. I really appreciate your support, helping the show pick up a lot of listeners and doing very well here at Blog Talk Radio in terms of generating an audience, and I really want to thank you all. And again, I want to say if you find these programs constructive, that it is a constructive investment of your time and energy, listen to the programs, use any suggestions or information that you feel is valuable. Share them with your friends. If you do not feel it is a constructive investment of your time and energy, please devote your time and energy to something that will be more productive for you, because I do not want to waste anyone's time if what I'm doing here is not constructive. I feel like non-white people, victims of white supremacy, we waste a lot of time on non-constructive activities, and I don't want to be a part of that. I don't really do this program to be a cool host of a radio program. I really do this program to make an effort to provide constructive information on the system of white supremacy, what it is and how it works, and ways it can be countered. So with that said, if you find it constructive, I thank you. Please check the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. One more time, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Want to get right into the program this week. I am very pleased and grateful for this week's guest. Visited with him earlier in the week. The guest this week, he is the director of diversity at the Bush School here in Seattle. The Bush School is an immaculate and intimidating facility. Guest took me all over the facility. I got snacks, trinkets, all sorts of goodies, shared all kinds of information about the school and what they do. I'm pretty much, you know, just a pauper, and he took me around the facility as though I was Bill Gates or someone. This week's guest also, in addition to being the director of diversity at the Bush School, is the founder of the White Privilege Conference. Anyone who is not familiar with that, if you are listening to this live on Blog Talk Radio, if you look at the show description, you'll see a link for the White Privilege Conference. You can go to that website. Lots of constructive information about the conference, tell you all about it. It'll be in Wisconsin next April, April 7th through the 10th. Hopefully I'll be there too. It'll be in Wisconsin. You can check the website. It's listed right in the show description and get all the information that you need about it. Founder of the White Privilege Conference, Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. is our guest this week. Dr. Moore, are you with us?
I am here. Yes, I am. Thank you for having me, my brother, and I want to apologize first off to your listening audience for my complete blunder last weekend. I just have no excuses. It just I missed the mark, but I'm happy that you were gracious enough to give me another opportunity to come back. And I just want to say hello to everybody listening. And once again, affirm and just congratulate you, my brother, for taking on such a challenging topic comprehensively in a challenging way, but what I think is a very fair and just way as well. So I'm just, again, honored and privileged to be a part of the show. So thanks again, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. I am grateful. Our listeners, I don't know if they are aware of this or not. Dr. Moore is not in Seattle where he normally spends his time and energy. Dr. Moore, tell them where you're calling from today, sir.
I'm actually on the heels of a conference called A Dream Deferred by the College Board, and then on the front end of another conference I'm attending this weekend called the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity. So I'm in the big city of Los Angeles, the great state of California, headed to San Diego, and so that's where I am calling remotely from the hotel lounge.
Yeah, see, Dr. Moore, in Southern California, right almost on summertime, so as opposed to being out frolicking at the beach or doing all of the wonderful things you can do in Southern California in the sunshine, he is here with us today at the COWS to talk about replacing white supremacy with justice. So I definitely want to extend a hearty thank you for taking your time out, busy weekend where you could be doing a lot of other things to speak with us, and hopefully we'll have constructive information. So again, I want to thank you, sir.
Happy to be here, bro. Let's get rolling.
Right on, right on. All business. First up, I wanted to ask your permission to ask you about all major areas of people activity as it relates to the system of white supremacy, and that would be education, entertainment, economics, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. Do I have your permission, sir?
You definitely have my permission, and I will do everything I can to answer to the greatest extent of my knowledge. If I don't know, I'll say I don't know.
Right on. I can dig it. I can dig it. I want to share with our listeners, I do have a photograph of you for those folks who are tuning in live, listening at Blog Talk Radio. But for those who are listening at the Counter Racism Network or elsewhere, are you a white person or a non-white person?
I am a brother from the neighborhood, so I'm a black man.
Okay.
Depending on what neighborhood you're in, I could be described in very different ways. But when I look in the mirror, I see a black man 150%, bro.
Okay. Okay. As a black male and a non-white male, is it correct to say that you are a victim of white supremacy? And when I say victim of white supremacy, I mean you have been mistreated because you are not white.
What I would say, bro, is I'm a recovering victim, because for me, victim leaves me in a helpless state, as if I'm, you know, still, although experiencing the impact of white supremacy every day, day to day, I am not surrendering to it. So for
yes,
me,
sir.
I would say a recovering victim, because I'm going back at it. As I'm taking blows, I'm swinging back.
Okay, okay. But you have been mistreated because you're not white.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
For those of our listeners who, I guess, are not familiar with the White Privilege Conference, don't know what that is, don't know what you do with that work that's been going on for 10 years strong and still kicking, I guess I would start simple, and then we can go into more detail. Privilege, what do you mean? Could you share that with our listeners? What do you mean when you use the word privilege?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had a 12-year-old kid stop at my exhibit, my vendor booth, yesterday, and he wanted a T-shirt, a white privilege T-shirt, and his dad made him ask me about privilege before he took the shirt so that he can explain it when people ask him about the shirt. And I asked the young brother, I said, man, what do you know about privilege? What is privilege? And he said to me, privilege is something you earn. You put effort forward, and therefore, because of that effort, you get things from that effort. And what I said to the young brothers, I commend you and all that kind of stuff for your understanding of privilege, but what we're talking about at the White Privilege Conference is unearned privilege, things you receive, perks you receive, benefits you receive, rewards you receive that are unearned, that are simply for the fact that you have white skin. So the White Privilege Conference, it is based on the concept that America was started by white people for white people. And all the systems and organizations and institutions they set up in the favor of white-skinned folks. And after hundreds of years, of course, we've had laws and changes and all those kinds of things. You can't deny that. However, what we try to do at the conference is look at, even though you change the laws, if you have a system that's worked in that way for hundreds of years, it still offers benefits and perks to folks simply because of that identity. And in this case, white skin privilege. So when you talk about privilege, from my vantage point, the definition is simple. It's unearned benefits or perks that you get simply because you show up in an identity. And in the case of white privilege, it's because of white skin privilege. The thing I will say that's important for people to understand about the White Privilege Conference is we don't just cover privilege from a skin-based perspective, from a race-based perspective. That's the foundation. Everything extends from there. But we also make sure we cover gender, language, sexual orientation, economics, religion. So we really try to cover privilege comprehensively, cover how everybody has privilege, and we're all affected by it in very different ways. But let's not fool ourselves that the foundation is white supremacy, white male dominance, the philosophical belief that really pioneered the construction of this place we call America and the systems and institutions that we operate in today.
Wow. Thank you. I appreciate that. I wanted to ask, I do this on every program, on this program, the definition of white supremacy that I use, white supremacy, a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that is a accurate definition of white supremacy?
My brother, I would say there is some real accuracy in that definition. The only thing I would respectfully present as a challenge to that definition is I think that people get folded into the behaviors of white supremacy and white privilege, even though they don't buy into the philosophical belief. So, yes, there are people who have a philosophical belief that white supremacy is the reigning top class of existence, and they will destroy everything outside of that philosophical belief and identity. And what I think happens is because of people's constructing systems and organizations under that belief, other folks who may not support that philosophy can also, in benefiting or in being unaware of it, can find themselves falling into behavior patterns associated with that. So I think that definition doesn't leave room for those who may be unwilling and unlike that mindset that supports that, but also unaware of the behavior patterns that they could be falling into that are simply reproducing the results that that system was set up to reproduce.
I want to make sure that I'm understanding what you just said correctly. This is a tip that Dr. Martin Kevorkian, a white man, a professor at the University of Texas and an admitted white supremacist, shared on a previous program to restate to make sure that you clearly understand what the person just said. You're saying that the definition that I used for white supremacy does not leave room for, I'm assuming, white people who might not necessarily agree with racism, white supremacy, but they still end up engaging in behaviors, perhaps unaware, unconsciously engaging in behaviors that support the system of white supremacy. Is that an accurate restatement of what you said?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. With these white people who are unaware of white supremacy and unaware of their complicity with that system, would they still be culpable as white supremacists because of their conduct in supporting the system of white supremacy?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that that is the space in which the White Privilege Conference is trying to prevent folks from going into, because it's not enough to say, I just didn't know, but if you're not following any kinds of actions or efforts to bring some consciousness and awareness, there comes a time when you just end up reproducing the system and taking on its identity. So absolutely, you can fall into the behavior patterns of that philosophical belief.
Okay. So I just want to be clear. Clarity is very important on discussions of white supremacy. Do you feel the definition that I gave is accurate, or you don't feel that it's accurate, that it would need to be changed to incorporate those white people who, although they do practice white supremacy, they are not aware?
Yeah, I think I'd have to, just my instinct right now tells me I need to chew on that a little bit more to better bring sense to some of what I even responded to in saying that. So as you're talking, as I'm listening to myself talk, as I'm thinking, I'm even, just saying, that was heavy, soaking that up myself. But let me go at answering that question specifically, my brother. Absolutely, there is a global system of white supremacy that I believe was created and designed to destroy non-white people. Mm-hmm. I think that's the manufacturing of slavery for me and my understanding of that system created that mechanism, that institution, that organization to destroy black people. And I think that you can go on down the line and find other ways in which that system created institutions, organizations, functioning kinds of patterns of behavior amongst folks to destroy non-white people. In addition to that, to promote whiteness as the supreme being. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%.
Okay. Words are very important, a critical aspect of what I have learned, and I am still learning like you. I make sure I want to share that as well. I am not an expert on racism, white supremacy, or anything else for that matter. But one of the few things that I have learned is that words are very important when doing work against racism, white supremacy. With that definition, and I just want to clarify because I do this every program, white people that I have had on my show, and I have used that same definition, the white people are 7-for-7 in saying they agree with that definition. It is accurate. You didn't say whether or not you agreed. Including you, the non-white people that I have had on the program are now 1-for-4 on whether or not they think that is accurate. And I continue to highlight this because I have long said white people are way more informed about racism, white supremacy, than non-white people. And I think just the responses that I have got around that definition from white people and non-white people would suggest that is true. I could be inaccurate. It's not really that many people. I mean, 11 total. Yeah. But I do think it's significant. White people, 7-for-7 in saying they agree and that would be an accurate definition for the system of white supremacy that we have. And a couple of the white people have even said, obviously. But, think about it. It might be inaccurate.
I'm just trying to take on the tool that you passed on to me from the good doctor. I think you said Kevorkian was his name, Mark. And restating what you're saying to me, that if I'm following your logic, that your feeling is my inability or others like myself, folks of color who've been on the show, to agree with that definition 100%, there leads you to believe that white people are more informed because they agree 7 for 7, or they hit it 7 for 7, so to speak. On that definition,
I would say, yeah, that's pretty close. I think the white people being on the program, 7 out of 7 of those white people, and many of them admitted white supremacists, saying that they feel that is an accurate definition for the system of white supremacy that we have, contrasting that with the number of non-white people who do not feel that that is accurate, and even one of those non-white people saying that they do not agree that there is a system of white supremacy, in my view, shows a difference in understanding about the system of white supremacy. A huge difference, I would say, because I do think there is a major gulf between what white people know about how racism, white supremacy works, what it is and how it works, in comparison to the non-white people, the victims of white supremacy, what they know about the system of white supremacy, what it is and how it works. So, yes, I would use that as one example that suggests white people are significantly more informed about racism, white supremacy.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as we continue and as I think more, I mean, I think the one thing I think of, my brother, is if you're talking to, you know, white supremacists, I mean, people who are part of this blueprint creation, I mean, I would assume they have a much more solid understanding of this system, particularly if they have a part of its reproduction or maybe a part of understanding how people constructed it, a lot better than I am. I think the thing that I only have a problem with your definition, I agree that the system is in place and the system is in effect and was created to do, as you said, it was created to do in your definition. The thing that I just raised some thought about and some challenge to in that statement is, what about those who may be folded up in that definition that may not be in agreement with that definition? And if it's even, maybe it's not even important that we give some attention to that, but that's the only thing I raised as a part of, you know, thinking about embracing that definition wholeheartedly. But you're right, I got to give some more thought to that. But I just wanted to see if I understood that logic, and I think I do, and I appreciate you giving me a little extra time on that so I can comprehend that and think about it and soak on it a little bit more. But moving forward, I'm sorry.
No apologies. That's what I make the show for. It's about learning, and I am still learning myself. If you tune into the program later, the definition might change as I learn more. So hey, no apologies at all. I did want to note, just before I move to the next question, your concern with the definition was a concern for white people. Is that correct? Specifically, white people who may not be conscious that their behavior is that of a white supremacist and that they are functioning to support the system of white supremacy.
Well, I mean, I think I just asked where is there room for those kinds of folks in there? I mean, I don't express it as, I'm not losing sleep over it as if, you know, a concern for my son or something like that. I just think from the vantage point in which I do the work and the places in which I've been doing it and the years I've been doing it amongst the White Privilege Conference constituency, I guess my question is, and from a just a black man receiving and being responding to that, is there room, or should we even be thinking about having room for those who may not follow that but may be in practice of that? I think that's the question I'm just reflecting on as I'm answering and thinking about it And maybe there's no need to give it thought, but that's just what came to me as I was responding.
Yes, sir. I think that's important. I think that's important. And that's why I spent extra time in going back to clarify, because I do think that's important. I also wanted to share, you have been doing the White Privilege Conference for 10 years, and you already have details about where the conference is going to be next year in Wisconsin next April. In all of the time that you have been doing this work with the White Privilege Conference, do you think you could give us the top five jewels, and I mean the best five suggestions for things non-white people and or white people can do that would help them combat racism, white supremacy?
You know, my brother, I'm not necessarily giving these in any order, but the first one that jumps to my mind is I jokingly say to folks at the end of some of the sessions I do, I say, just go home and say white supremacy in the mirror like 10 times. White supremacy, white supremacy, white supremacy, white. I mean, really, really getting yourself to the point where you can just have comfort in your conversations around diversity or cultural competency, which are some of the more comfortable buzzwords around this work. So you can have comfort even articulating white supremacy in your day-to-day conversations around these kinds of issues. That's number one. We got to have white supremacy, white privilege, other forms of oppression comprehensively in the conversation when we're talking about the more kind and gentle kinds of stuff like diversity or culture competency. That's number one. Number two, I think that it has to be a collective, collaborative effort. I think because people engage the topic at such different levels that you have to be willing to bring the conversation to them at the level that they exist. Now, I'm not saying stay at Diversity 101, watch black people dance, or know what kind of food Asian folks eat, which is sometimes some folks' superficial approach to this work. It's like a diversity card, punch card approach. I'm not saying that stay in 101, but I'm saying that sometimes you have to engage folks where they are, but you gotta take them to the level of white supremacy, white privilege. That's gotta be a goal that you want to get them to in talking about that issue. That's number two. I think the definition that you raised, and I would encourage you to put that in your somewhere visible so that folks are even chewing on that as they're listening to this show day to day, every day. But I think that we need to have white supremacy and questions around that and that definition and understanding what the people who put this system together were thinking. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any kind of recent kinds of classes, even when I visit college campuses, where young people are engaging white male supremacy dominance as a system. Understanding the blueprint and what folks were thinking about when they put those systems forward. So I think that we need to have more coursework, more workshops, more kinds of shows like this where we're examining white supremacy as a global system and institution and its destruction of non-white people. I think that that has to be a part of it. I tell people, and the last two I'll say is you got to take this conversation to your personal space as well. And for me, I think one of the top five things we want people to do leaving the White Privilege Conference is to take this to your personal space. Don't just make this about a two-day or three-day conference experience. Bring it to the place and to the people you love the most. I know for me, sometimes the toughest work I have to do is with the people I love the most. But I think that that has to be a part of what we do, and part of my top five as well is taking it local, which is home, to the people you love the most. And the last thing is if anything, do something. You know, I think for me, I am so frustrated. My brother, I used to be more frustrated with people I'd see on the, you know, in some tough situations, and it looked as if they weren't, you know, making any effort to get out of their situation. You know, when I was recovering from some of this internalized kinds of stuff that I've been working on myself, I used to always kind of take, man, if they just pull themselves up, you know, I didn't really, you know, I mean, I think I tried to keep a little space between really, you know, being like, being a kind of person that says pull yourself up by the bootstrap. But I still had that voice playing in my head when I would pass folks where it seemed as if they weren't making any effort, and I would be frustrated. In the 21st century, my frustration is with the folks who have the most privilege, the most resources, and the most ability to do something in the spaces where they exist, and they're not capitalizing on that 150%. And so I think in the 21st century, what I'm asking the most privileged to do is something. It's not about giving to people. It's not about lifting people up. It's not about taking people here or trying to get there to these. It's about really making some day-to-day effort every day in the privileged position you sit in to do something towards social justice every day. And here's what I'll say, which sometimes doesn't win me a lot of accolades when I'm talking to folks around this work. I have proposed what I call the theory of incapability. Okay? And here's what I'm saying, my brother. And this is kind of the foundation in which those five tips and the other kinds of things that I'm doing are built on. I don't believe that white people, and in this case, I'm just going to take young black males because that's an area in which I'm working with teachers and teacher preparation. And also I'm going to focus my energy and efforts over the next decade and do hopefully, no, let me rephrase that, and do around that issue what I've done around the issue of white privilege in the White Privilege Conference. But I don't think white teachers, as an example, since I'm doing education, are capable of seeing genius in black males. I think they're incapable of seeing genius in black males because when we were brought together, we were never brought together for them to see genius inside of you and me. We were brought together for them to see nigger, not scholar. And because of that bringing together, I believe that white people are incapable of seeing genius. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but what the theory of incapability proposes that when you operate as if you're incapable, in order to accomplish the task, you got to do something every day because the system will pull you back into nigger paradigm as opposed to scholar paradigm. So for me, moving forward, I'm proposing the theory of incapability as the model in which people operate, that you act as if you can't do it because the system's design is for you to conquer, to see nigger, not scholar. And it's not that it's impossible. I'll rephrase, I'll say that again and make sure folks hear me here. I'm not presenting a doomsday scenario here. I'm just saying, if you're going to accomplish it, if it's going to be possible, you got to do work every day because this system of white supremacy is designed not for genius to come from black males, but for slaves to come from Africans. That's what the systems did. And I think that we have got to have a different approach in the 21st century. I just believe, my brother, we're 10 years almost into the 21st century, almost the first decade. And if you look at it in the ship metaphor, kind of like a big cruise ship, so to speak, it seems to me that after these first 9 or 10 years, that this ship that we call, let's say, America, so to speak, is beginning to set sail in the same direction it set sail in the last 100 years. And what I'm saying is I'm not happy about that, especially educationally when it comes to young black males. So let's try something new. Let's put something new out there as a model. And so I'm not one to, you know, be naive and believe that I've come up with something that, you know, maybe others haven't said. So I don't want to act as if and be disrespectful of of my elders who have come before me, because they may have presented this already. But for me, this is how the work has come to me over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying when I'm getting that kind of action-oriented or top five questions is, no matter what I lay out in that top five, what you have to understand is I believe in the theory of incapability. And when you take that approach, that you have to do something every day, to me, it's a different level of engagement in doing the work in the 21st century.
Wow. Wow. I've jotted down notes, your top five and the theory of incapability. I took down notes because I have some other questions that are going to coincide nicely with some of the responses that you just gave. So I'm going to continue asking questions, but this is going to come up again in the interview, so I don't want anyone to think that I am minimizing what was just said. I was smiling quite a bit because it's going to come back up in the interview, so sit tight. Oh, yeah, for audience members that are listening to the program, call-in number is 347-215-6071, and the rule for the callers, this is very important, because I was listening to a program with a non-white person, and we were having a discussion about a comment that someone made. We didn't know if it was a white person or a non-white person, so we want to resolve that from this point forward. When you call in, you don't have to give your name, but you do need to tell us if you're a white person or a non-white person. Very important information. So, yes, moving forward, but the things that you just said, very important. I will be touching on them repeatedly as we move forward. Could you share with us the demographics of the White Privilege Conference? Is it mostly white people? Is it about an even mix? Is it mostly non-white people? And if you feel like you make an effort to target white people or non-white people or, you know, everybody, could you share that information?
Yes, yes. So a couple of things around the demographics from the conference. One, I think last year, definitely the year before, we're beginning to see about a 60-40 split, white folks of color. Now, I need to double check, and maybe my demographic person is listening, my statistic person is listening, and they can call in and give me the exact details. I hope so. But what I want to say in reference to that is the conference started in Iowa, the great state of Iowa. So it's important to keep in mind those demographics. And really, a good part of the constituency that came to the conference in its original start came from that Midwest, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota region. So we, in the first parts of the conference, definitely were in the 70, 75 white folks, and then the rest people of color. So we're beginning to see a shift in that. So it wasn't early on as if I was targeting white people. I was just trying to get people to come and talk about white privilege. And I think now what we do, a couple of different things, is one, not only do we want to see a representation of folks. Okay, I think what we want to see is not only a mixture of folks from different kinds of demographic representations, but we also want to bring in, you know, education, nonprofit, community organizers. So what I'm really working to do is to bring in a diverse kind of workforce or representation of the workforce or people doing the work across the nation, in addition to young people. So the one thing we do at the White Privilege Conference is we bring in high school kids, because I really believe that we need to be engaging young people around these issues of white privilege. And, yes, I am definitely trying to get young white kids to begin to take on this white privilege, white supremacy conversation, so that when they're in college, they're not like most of the college kids or graduate student kids that I see today, or even grown white folks I see today. It's like, what do you mean privilege? I don't have privilege. I work for everything I have. You know, it's like I'm doing that battle a lot of times, day to day, every day, and really bringing in high school kids. Hopefully what I want to accomplish is at least having these kids comfortable with the language and understanding of the system and its design, and then being able to go out in the different kinds of places and spaces that there exist and applying that in the things that they do day to day, every day. So that's a little bit about the demographics and the people that come to the conference.
Okay. Very interesting. The White Privilege Conference, you are a black male. When I first heard about the White Privilege Conference, I assumed white people were running this organization. When I found out it was a non-white person, I was a tad befuddled. Do you think it's strange that a non-white person is the founder of the White Privilege Conference? And has anyone ever said to you that they think it's, you know, a little strange that a non-white person is the founder of the White Privilege Conference?
Yeah, I had that yesterday. I mean, I'll get that at the next conference I go to. I get that all the time. I mean, I've had sometimes people not even see me, and I've been in their friendship circle, but then we've met, and I put out flyers about the conference. They're like, you're the founder? You know, so I get that all the time. Here's the thing I tell the people at the start of the conference, and I'm trying to do this every year. One, this is not a diversity conference, so we're not here to sing Kumbaya. We're here to examine the system of white supremacy, white privilege, and oppression. And in everything we do, that has to be a part of what we do. Secondly, though, and also most importantly, this is a conference founded by a black man, an African-American black man, Afrocentric in my core, in my understanding. Although, I mean, I was raised in white supremacy, so to speak. It's not like I received Afrocentric training or curriculum when I was growing up, but I believe that's my core. Mm. And so what I say to people is I want you to take this seed of the White Privilege Conference wherever you go. Grow it wherever you exist. But understand this. The Eurocentric model will not grow this seed because it is an African seed. And that's really the challenge that I want people to understand. Now, whether people support or like or are confused or not sure and why, I mean, here's what I believe, my brother, and what I sleep well knowing is that this conference is bigger than me. It's not like I was growing up saying, someday I'm going to find this White Privilege Conference and do this great work. That's not what I grew up thinking I would do. So I know that the fact that I'm doing this is far bigger than me, far greater than me. There's a power greater than me that I believe fueling and guiding me in doing this conference. And I go to bed knowing not exactly the answer to why did this or how did this, but knowing that something greater than me brought this into existence. And that's really the fuel that keeps me going and trying to help people understand that I think, for me, I think we all have work to do in reference to understanding and dismantling issues of white supremacy and white privilege and bringing forth justice.
Mm, for sure. I agree wholeheartedly there. What and or whom is producing white privilege?
Oh, man, I think what and whom is producing white privilege? I mean, for me, my belief is I don't think there's a system or organization or institution that doesn't exist that isn't either consciously or unconsciously producing or bringing forth white privilege because of the grounding and foundation that they stand, which is white supremacy.
Hmm.
So, I mean, for me, I think the question I try to ask myself, how is it that I am bringing forth or I am having to deal with some internalized issues as a consequence of a system designed under white supremacy? So, I mean, I don't know if I don't feel like I can say, here it is as a source. If you can help me or got some knowledge on that or others got some knowledge and others have knowledge on that, I'd be happy to hear some of that. But I don't feel like I have a person or a place or exact kind of location of where it is. I see it as comprehensive in everything that we do day to day, every day. And I think it starts as young as, you know, little kids in kindergarten, if not before.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sometimes being grounded in the space and places that they exist.
Mm-hmm. I know Dr. Robert Jensen, he is a white man, also professor at the University of Texas, Austin. His book, The Heart of Whiteness, he said, page 92, the problem is white people. I would say specifically the white people who practice white supremacy. If someone were to ask me whom is producing white privilege, my response would be the white people who practice white supremacy produce white privilege. I could be incorrect, but I believe at the end of the day, we're talking about people, specifically people who classify themselves as white, who are responsible for this. I think that would be correct. I noticed in the brochure, the press packet that you gave me on the White Privilege Conference, and in some of the videos that I watched, both the one that you gave me and some of the ones that I saw online, I saw repeatedly it was said that the White Privilege Conference was not created to beat up on white folks or attack white folks. Did you feel that that needed to be said explicitly, and if so, why?
Yeah, I think because of my mama. It's how I answer that, because I think for me, what she taught me most is that you got to have a grounding in love in how you do this work. Now, I think that there's a way to push people, challenge people, press people, but to do it in a way that's respectful and loving. But I'm also not naive to believe that everybody's, as I say to people in my trainings, there are some pancakes you'll never flip over. So I'm not a fool to believe that everybody's going to move along this continuum, so to speak. But you got to call out the racists and the white supremacists when you see them, because you can't spend energy trying to flip those folks over. But I think that when there are opportunities to bring folks forward, that for me, I think the ways in which that's accomplished and you experience the greatest success is if it's done on a foundation of love and respect, which is what my mama taught me. So I think for me, the conference success happens because of relationships.
Mm.
The thing that I enjoyed before the conference came forward was organizing community conversations in an environment where people felt like it was family. So trying to have a tough conversation about, was Jesus a white man in Iowa, in Dubuque, Iowa, at a small Catholic college in Dubuque, Iowa, was a challenging conversation. But creating it in a space where people felt like it was family there was really kind of the blueprint and catalyst for organizing the White Privilege Conference. And that's why I want people knowing, coming to the conference, we're not here to operate in a mode of attack, in a mode of degrading. And I think that's important to accomplish what it is we're trying to accomplish, which is to engage these conversations at a high level, to not let people slide by. Now, not to give people green lights, so to speak, not to push them, not to press them. And that includes the speakers as well.
For sure.
But I think it's important to do it, for me, in an environment that's built on relationships, that's grounded on love and community, which is, for me, as I describe it, a big piece of what I carry with me from my teachings from my mother.
Outstanding. Do you think, as a non-white person and a recovering victim of white supremacy, do you think the white people who practice white supremacy should be attacked?
Well, could you? Are you saying like a person like David Duke? I guess when I'm sorry, I interrupted. You're gonna start the answer to that. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Can you give me an example of a kind of person you would say that is practicing white supremacy?
I would have to think of people. As a non-white person, I am not able to label any white person as a white supremacist. So the only people that I could go to are the white people who say, I am a white supremacist. And I know quite a few of them, actually. Martin Kevorkian, who was on this show, admitted white supremacist. Farrell Winfrey admitted white supremacist. David Duke said he was, but he has since recanted that, so I don't know. Other individuals who've been on YouTube's Gretna Blast admitted white supremacist. Those are three individuals I can think of. I'm sure there are others. I guess you could think of a KKK member. Any of these people admitted white supremacists. Do you think, as admitted white supremacists, these white people should be attacked?
Well, for me, that's not where I want to spend my energy. I think they should be called out, particularly if they're in positions of power and institutional organizational influence. I think that if one of those people, was teaching at a college, or if they were owner of a bank, I think the beauty of and the difficulty we face in the 21st century, we may have a Mark Kevorkian, but under disguise or in disguise, so to speak. So I think for me, that's where my challenge lies, is trying to not spend energy attacking those like that who are openly and outwardly spewing what it is that they spew in reference to white supremacy. But I want to try to find those who are of that same mentality, yet they are able to hide it and disguise it in other forms of behavior. And so that's the kind of work I think I want to spend my time doing in the 21st century. And I don't know how, brother, to be honest with you, what my spirit would do in engaging a gentleman like Kevorkian. But I think what I want to ask you, if I can, ask the host,
yes,
or maybe the listeners, is do you believe that kind of attack should go towards a person like Robert Jensen, who seems to be writing and teaching around these kinds of issues, particularly in a place like the University of Texas, which to me looks like it's a good thing. So should he be experiencing the attacks that a person like Kevorkian experience? Is he classified as a white supremacist?
Well, he didn't admit to being a white supremacist, although he did say it is logical and it is correct that as long as the system of white supremacy exists, non-white people at minimum should view every white person as an admitted racist or a suspected racist. So the suspected racist known as Dr. Robert Jensen, I would evaluate his work, see what he does, but I certainly would subject him to quite a bit of scrutiny. When I say attack, I don't mean physical violence, but I certainly feel, because, I mean, you have economic sanctions, you can attack people without necessarily being physically violent with them. But I certainly think any white person under the system of white supremacy should be under suspicion, and I definitely think they should be questioned. They should be interrogated. They should be thoroughly scrutinized with regards to what they are doing to replace white supremacy with justice. And I think that that in and of itself is a form of an attack when you have non-white people and or white people thoroughly investigating and scrutinizing everything that a white person does and says or is not doing or not saying in the system of white supremacy. And I also wanted to clarify, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, he's not a KKK member. He is a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. He is a colleague of Dr. Robert Jensen. He's not in the Klan, to my knowledge. He's not in the Klan or anything. He wrote a book on racism in films and commercials and things of that nature. He didn't say he was a white supremacist in his book. He admitted it when he came on this program during the course of the discussion. He admitted to being a white supremacist. But, yeah, that's my view. I think the white people who practice white supremacy are the number one terrorists in the world. If anyone should be attacked, we should be starting with them, because no one causes more damage than the white people who practice racism, white supremacy. These are the biggest gangsters, the biggest criminals in the known universe. So if anyone should be attacked, it should be the white people who practice white supremacy. But I could be incorrect.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what you're saying. That language piece is so critical. Words are so powerful. For me, when I assumed attack, I didn't assume physical. I think sometimes, as I've learned it, when people say attack, it's just you know, really coming down on folks, so to speak, whether it's their character or their intentions and all of that. But I think what you mentioned in reference to scrutiny, in reference to hesitancy or suspicion or critical analysis, I don't find many ways to disagree with that, if any, at all. I think that under a system of white supremacy, absolutely, white people should be under critical analysis. Absolutely. Now, I don't describe that as attack, but that may be semantic. I think under a system of male privilege, of created by men for men, that we should be viewed with hesitancy in reference to gender issues and relationships with women. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think the question I have is when you're dealing with a 16-year-old high school kid that's white and trying to come to a understanding and awareness, is that the same level of scrutiny or questioning or attack that you should be dealing with Robert Jensen or an admitted kind of racist or recovering white supremacist or recanting white supremacist as David Duke? Or should you have different kinds of strategies or ways in which you're dealing with those different levels of folks?
I definitely think that the white people who practice racism, white supremacy, you have more powerful white people who practice white supremacy, and that definitely should be factored in to how you deal with that particular white supremacist. I will say this in reference to the 16-year-old white person. I'll answer with an anecdote. Earlier this week, a victim of white supremacy was questioning a white person about racist jokes, and she shared that in high school, this white person and her white friends joked about how they could do a better job with the Holocaust, meaning they could have outperformed Hitler. I'll answer and just leave it at that. That was what she said they were doing in high school. I wanted to ask, do you suspect any of the white speakers who have been at your conferences could be white supremacists?
Now, when you say white, are you saying recovering white supremacists, or are you saying like active, engaged,
the second,
in disguise white supremacists?
The second, that they are active, that they are participating in the system of global abuse of non-white people, yes.
And maliciously intent and with intent.
Yes.
Okay. My brother, my motto is I'm prepared for everything and surprised by nothing. So I would say to you, I can't say that that's not at the White Privilege Conference or hasn't been speakers or participants, keynotes or workshop folks. I have to say I could have missed it, absolutely. I also would say that there are definitely, without hesitation, folks who are engaging in white supremacist destructive behavior and not having a clue about it. In fact, this is why I have extended an open invitation for you to be at the White Privilege Conference, We have folks of color saying at the White Privilege Conference, folks are behaving in an unhealthy way, like white supremacists or around issues of racism at the conference. So it's not like at the White Privilege Conference they leave it at the door. So absolutely. But I think for me, that's what we need to be doing around this issue. I just can't remember, for me, being able to hear on the airwaves or even in many classrooms, we have said white supremacy probably more than some folks have heard it in their lifetime in this one show. And I think that moving forward, this is a part of what we need to do, and I think calling it out as malicious intent, as disguise, and scrutiny and critical analysis, I think that's critical. I think that's important. So, yeah, I could have missed some, bro, and they could be there, absolutely.
Okay. Have any of the white speakers admitted to being white supremacists at the conference?
Well, I think yes, there have been white speakers who have admitted to being racist and admitted that all white people are racist because of the way the system is designed. And that's, for me, I think where I pull some of my language around a recovering or anti kind of victim, so to speak. So for me, what I look for is when white people are admitting or able to come to an awareness where they can admit that all white people are racist or in the case of men, sex. I think what I want to look for is action, because that's what anti means or recovering mean. And so I don't remember if I've heard somebody say from the stage that they are a white supremacist, but I definitely have heard folks acknowledge that because of the system of white supremacy and the way America was designed, that all white people are racist. And hopefully they're recovering or anti-racist. Now, is what you're saying, white people admitting to being racist, synonymous to white people admitting to being white supremacist? Do you see those as synonymous, as one?
Yes. The term racism I use interchangeably with the term white supremacy. Racism is white supremacy. White supremacy is racism. The only functional form of racism in the known universe is white supremacy. So for me, if someone says, I am an admitted racist, that would be the same as if they said, I am an admitted white supremacist.
So if when a white person admits to being a racist, have you seen it where they also they will not admit to being a white supremacist, that they see that differently, or is that have you faced that before where people don't see those as synonymous?
In the conversations that I have had with white people, I'm on my toes about terms, and I make a concerted effort to be very consistent in using the term white supremacy almost exclusively. I have been a little more lax because I've been talking to more non-white people, and it's been my experience that non-white people are uncomfortable with the term white supremacy. So I use racism a little more so that I can have more constructive dialogue with non-white people. But in talking to white people, I have never had a white person show discomfort about me using the term white supremacy. I have never had a white person say that racism is not equal to white supremacy. Never. Now, when I have just been exclusively using the term racism and observing others exclusively use the term racism, it opens the door for white people that I suspect are consciously practicing racism to say, well, non-white people are racist too, which I don't agree with, and I completely avoid that argument by just using the term white supremacy, because the logic of the term white supremacy takes over. And so everyone pretty much knows you can't be a non-white person and be a white supremacist. I've never really had that pop up in a conversation. So To answer your question, no, I've never had a white person argue or grapple and say that being a racist is not equivalent to white supremacy, that those two terms are not synonymous. Never.
Yeah, I definitely look forward as you continue to take that inquiry to some larger numbers, and I really appreciate you even pushing me back on that, because I got a man, you got me on a psychological thirst right now, bro. So I do appreciate that, and I got to give that some real thought, because I'm asking myself, where does that come from for me? Where has that disconnection come from me? Why is it that I see those two as different? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask, what definition do you have for the term racism?
Racism, I have power versus prejudice, meaning you have a prejudice towards someone's race, and you have the power to enact something against that. So that's what racism is for me, is prejudice plus power.
Okay. And what do you mean when you use the term white supremacy?
White supremacy is a belief that whiteness and the existence of whiteness is supreme.
Okay. And if we're in a system of white supremacy, you would have power if you are a white supremacist, yes?
Yes. Oh, well, yeah, I think, would you have power?
As a white supremacist in a system of white supremacy, you would have power, yes?
As a white, I'm just thinking back on my own learning too, and I think what I learned is that all white people are racist because of a system that is built on racism, built on white supremacy. So in my mind, you can help me make sense. I'm just talking this out loud and actually trying to make sense of it and trying to figure out why and where it is and trying to answer that question. So I see white supremacy as this foundation, as this blanket that I believe whiteness is supreme. So what is key is to spread that in what it is I do. So not everybody would have the power to enact that are white. I don't think every white person has the power to enact that. And I think some whites may make a decision or may not be raised to believe that whiteness is supreme. I don't think all whites are raised in that way. I don't believe, at least in thinking about that. And so that's what sets white supremacy up in a way that's different, in that because of the system and what exists for all of us living in it, white people, there are perks that come from a whiteness system, and that you don't have to accept that and believe it, but you still get a perk from that. And as a racist, I would hope that as a recovering racist, so to speak, that you would be trying to understand ways in which you're not enacting that kind of whiteness power. Man, I think that I'm just in a thought pattern to say, is that synonymous? Is whiteness or white supremacy synonymous with racism?
I would again this, and I again I'm still learning. I am not an expert. I could be incorrect. So you are doing the best thing, thinking about it, and you will make sense of it based on your logic and understanding. And you're founder of the White Privilege Conference. I'm sure you are in touch with a lot of people who can give you more information and insight on this. My one observation. You use the term whiteness, recovering white supremacist, racist, and white supremacist. That's a lot of terms, and I'm certain all of those terms would have different meanings. That has been one thing, a major critical point that I would say in learning about racism, white supremacy. Words are very important. I began this show getting a definition for white supremacy, and I begin every show definition for white supremacy, every program, and I use the same definition. Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., he was on the program last week. He has done a lot of work on racism, white supremacy. He is working on producing a glossary of terms just around racism, white supremacy. It has been my experience that non-white people end up picking up a lot of terms talking about racism, white supremacy, but they are not able to clearly explain what these terms mean, and I think that highlights that lack of understanding that I was talking about. I've never had resistance from any white person in saying racism equals white supremacy and using those terms interchangeably. Never. When Farrell Winfrey, an admitted white supremacist, came on the program, she said all white people are racist. When I changed that too, and it wasn't even a conscious change because in my mind those terms are the same thing. I even say them, racism, white supremacy, often. When I said, so do you think it would be constructive if all non-white people adjusted their thoughts, speech, and action to the belief that every white person, no exception, is a white supremacist, she said, yes, that would be constructive. And I asked her twice. She said, yes. I'm not trying to say that I am, you know, definitive. This is the gospel. This has just been my observation, and I think that's very important if you're going to do work, anyone, myself included, if you're going to do constructive work on racism, white supremacy, got to be very clear with terms. And if racism and white supremacy are not the same, we need to be very clear about pointing out why they are not, and they need to have different definitions. Now, I don't believe that's true, but anyone, if you're going to take that stance, you got to be real clear in defining both of those terms and making sure that that is announced, that these are not the same, and this is why I don't think they're the same. But I don't think that's the case. And I'd be curious to ask the white people that you have at your conference if they think that's the case. I would be very curious, and particularly if they started agreeing and saying that they are the same, I would also be curious as to how it is that non-white people are attending this conference and thinking that racism and white supremacy are not the same, but the white people are thinking they are the same. Very interesting.
Interesting. I want to invite you to do that, and I want to say that again, that whatever we can do to make that happen and have that be a part of what comes out of your experience at the conference, in addition to, I'm sure, some other things, I myself want to definitely play a role in supporting that happening at the White Privilege, because we could definitely take those numbers from the teens or where they are now to the hundreds and begin to show some substantive, at least large numbers in response to what you're saying.
I'm all game. I'm already telling folks I would love to be broadcast live from Wisconsin next April, April 7th through the 10th in Wisconsin for the 11th White Privilege Conference. We can do the counter racism barbecue there. Hakima, everybody from the code.net, we should all rendezvous in Wisconsin. This would be a wonderful environment to run counter racist experiments. There should be tons of white people who are more than happy to chat with us about racism, white supremacy, and to get clarity and get constructive information. I will be there with bells on. Hakima, have the bell bottoms. It'll be classic. And I wanted to know, because we do have callers who are waiting on the line, give me 10 minutes. I'll get to the phone lines. A few more questions. I'm thoroughly enjoying my conversation with Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., founder of the White Privilege Conference. I am learning a lot as well, sir, so everybody is getting constructive information. the video that you gave me, that's, I guess, the promotional clip for the White Privilege Conference, I watched it, and in the beginning, it was showing footage. I guess the conference was kicking off, and the person was coming up to introduce and welcome everybody to the conference, and the camera panned the audience, and it was a room full of white people. The white people got up, or there were non-white people present, but it looked like mostly white people. The audience stood up, and they were clapping and cheering. My initial response, I laughed. And when I stopped laughing, I looked, and the white people were cheering, very loud, whistling. And I said, I remembered another admitted white supremacist, Mr. David Allen. He is chair of women's studies at the University of Washington. He said, on video, he said, anything that makes white people happy, non-white people should take a long, hard look at it and wonder, why are these white people happy? That should be the position non-white people take as long as there is a system of white supremacy. When I saw the white people cheering, yelling, clapping, after I stopped laughing, I said, I do not think anything constructive is going to happen if these white people are this happy about being at the White Privilege Conference. What are your thoughts on a non-white person, that being, that those were my thoughts on seeing the video? What do you think about that?
You know, I think the thing there is, and I would hope we could find some agreement on this, that you can't really cast that kind of, I don't think, cloud over it without experiencing it. I mean, I think for me, I take this show as an example, bro. I receive a couple calls saying, people saying, why this show? Do you know this guy? Where do you know this guy from? You know, it's like, they, in their minds already, they've made a judgment on the brother. And I'm saying, I met the brother. I've had comments say, you don't even know the brother. So for me, that's my reaction in general. I think I can give you some context of the applause and why people were standing. I think that I am not unwilling to embrace in some circumstances what you said. I usually use that in movies. In the movie, I call it trash. Some people call it crash. But I felt like there's too many white folks were just loving that movie. You know, I just thought, for me, that just didn't, something wasn't right about that. So in some occasions, yes, I've implored that. But I do think that my life experience has taught me that you at least got to, you know, yourself, give it some time, and I did that with Trash or Crash, even though I got some real problems with the movies. I do think there are some things in there that can be used for in a productive way. So,
okay, and I also want to highlight that as well. I have never been to the White Privilege Conference, so I'm not in a position to make any comments about what happened. It might have been the most constructive counter-racist effort ever. It might have been 1,000 times more constructive than anything I have done. I have never been. But hopefully that'll be corrected next April. I will be there, and I will have a front row seat so that I can observe what all this cheering is about. hopefully. I wanted to ask you, one of the things that I saw in the literature, in the press packet that I got, and in the videos that I watched on the White Privilege Conference, a recurrent theme seemed to be that white people are ignorant about racism, white supremacy. Do you feel that that's true? You're the founder. Do you feel that that's something that's brought up repeatedly, that white people are not aware of racism, white supremacy? They are not aware of how non-white people are systematically mistreated worldwide under the system of white supremacy.
Yeah, I don't title that as ignorance myself, but yeah, I think that there's definitely a great number of white people across the U.S., because that's my experience, that are have never even engaged this topic and definitely unaware of the global impact of the system of white supremacy. Absolutely.
I know Peggy McIntosh, one of her articles, The Invisible Privilege Knapsack, and she's been one of the speakers at your conference. Is that correct?
She has, yes. Yes.
Okay. And she is a white white female, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. McIntosh, her article, and it's, you know, pretty renowned. Some students here were using that article in their discussion on racism, or they will be next week. And I know many other college students have read that article and use her metaphor of this invisible privilege knapsack. How is it that, I guess, how is it that you feel, or why is it that you feel that so many white people are not aware, that they're not conscious of the system of racism, white supremacy?
Because it's good to them. That could be one reason, that it is good to be white in a system under white supremacy. So one reason could be just goodness, comfort, and all the perks that come with it. Secondly, could be isolation, just being in a place where issues that examine, or just a mindset of critical analysis just doesn't exist. I think critical thinking is something that needs to be strengthened and grown and developed in young people. And so some people may just be in environments where that's not even a part of how they're brought up. They're just brought up to fall into the traditional classical paths of the folks that have come before them. And so I think, and lastly, I think that, Obama is a perfect example. I mean, when people see the kind of things that have happened, whether it's, president in this current state, or Condoleezza Rice, or the brother Colin Powell. I mean, when people see those kinds of high power positions with folks of color, they just may think, things aren't that bad. I mean, still be a little, prejudice across the nation. Like, look at all this progress. Look at Oprah. So I think those are three of the things that I would say could play a role in people being where they are, so unaware in such large numbers in reference to these issues.
This is actually something Mr. Tim Wise, we finally got a firm date. Mr. Tim Wise. Oh, there you go. Mr. Tim Wise is an admitted white supremacist. He's been at your conference. That's one. Mr. Tim Wise, the admitted white supremacist, he will be on this program June 1st, 11:30 a.m. Pacific, 2:30 p.m. Eastern, Monday, June 1st. This will be a central topic that we address, white people being unconscious, ignorant of the system of racism, white supremacy. I'll simply say that the non-white male victim of white supremacy, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., has stated that white people cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. He was on the program last week. For anyone, you can go back and check the archives and hear him explain his view on why he feels that that is true. Now, the admitted white supremacist known as Farrah Winfrey came on this program and said she felt that statement was false, that white people certainly can and are be ignorant about racism. However, she came back on this program and we walked through the logic of why white people have to be more informed about racism, white supremacy, than non-white people. This was on April 1st. Anyone, if you want to go back and check the archives, we went through the logic, and she had to reverse and say, yes, white people are more informed about racism, white supremacy, than non-white people. I have seen this illustrated really daily. When I speak to white people, they have an overstanding of the importance of definitions. Non-white people tend to be the ones who struggle understanding why definitions are critical when you discuss white supremacy. Even this week, I saw a non-white person who was not clear about whether she was white or not. We had been talking about racism for a good hour, and she admitted, "I don't know if I'm a white person or a non-white person," at which point I asked that the white people share with us so we could all know, is this a white person? And they all said no, promptly, no ambiguity at all. In my view, that right there beautifully illustrates white people are much more informed. Just not having any confusion about whether or not a person is white or not white, that right there means you are more informed, because as a non-white person, I really cannot classify a white person as white or not. So that's my view. I think that is I think it's a very dangerous position to take for non-white people to begin to say that white people are not informed about racism, white supremacy. This is something I definitely want to I really want to take this up with white people, because really I feel this is a standard white supremacist tactic to say that white people are ignorant, white people are not informed about racism, white supremacy, we just didn't know. I feel that is a standard tactic that white people use who practice white supremacy to confound and confuse non-white people. If anybody's ignorant, it's me and the other victims of white supremacy, non-white people who do not know what white supremacy is and how it works. I wouldn't
be in disagreement with that, bro. I'm not in any way in saying that there are white folks who don't know that there aren't white folks who do know. I'm not saying that I would not disagree. I'm not saying and wouldn't disagree with you in saying that some folks use that as a strategy. They act as if they didn't have a clue when in fact they knew doggone well what they were doing. Mm-hmm. I'm not arguing that in any way. In fact, I would go so far to argue that part of where we face challenges in the 21st century is there are some folks who have the ability to know exactly when and how to play that kind of card, that I don't know or I didn't know kind of card. It's I didn't know you couldn't call him a nigger. I had no idea. You know, it's like this is 2009. Are you kidding me? So I think that I am in agreement with you. My experience shows me, and this may have just been, you know, because I lived in Iowa so long, that there are some folks who just don't know. And I think that what this conversation has helped me to do, and what I'll continue to do in a more aggressive and critical fashion, is bringing language to whether or not more folks of color need to be spending the energy and be identified as having a clue, and more white folks need to be challenged about, you may know. So I appreciate that, but I think my Iowa experience in particular has brought me into experience with folks that did not have a clue. And so I think for me, when I answer that question, that's the experience I'm answering it from.
Okay.
And what Seattle has taught me, what the Pacific Nice West, so to speak, has taught me, is folks will floss. Mm. Folks will smile at you for hours straight on your work day as if they're happy to have you around and be straight flossing. So I'm in agreement with you, bro. And I think for me, that's why these kinds of collaborations have to continue to happen. We may not be in wholehearted agreement on everything, but we care about justice.
For sure.
And I think that for me, although I feel like we're not going to reach a 100% agreement rate, this is what the spirit of the White Privilege Conference is trying to accomplish, that folks sitting where we sit, even as non-white folks trying to accomplish justice, are doing it in a way that's collective, collaborative, even though it's not even in full unison together, so to speak.
Mm. Wow. Oh, yeah, for sure. And I certainly, when I do the business of counter-racism, I certainly do not expect or look for agreement on everything. I've never talked to anyone, non-white person or white person, where we had complete agreement on every thought, idea, or strategy about racism, white supremacy. But I, too, believe the dialogue is critical. Listeners, you got 3 minutes, and I'll be getting the phone lines. When I met you at the presentation with Mr. Tim Wise, where you were instrumental in bringing Mr. Tim Wise here to Seattle to speak at the Bush School and then giving the public an opportunity to hear him as well at Mount Zion Church. When we spoke there, you emailed some of the speakers that you've had at the White Privilege Conference, and you said that I pissed you off respectfully. I was very curious to know what I did that upset you when I met you that night at the Tim Wise presentation.
Yeah, I think what I like, well, I guess for me that's not a bad thing, is that I felt at that time upon our first encounter that racism and white supremacy, although I didn't know that, this is the thing I think in my mind, as I that synonymous definition, as I said earlier, didn't leave room for folks who were trying to do the work, so to speak. And so I also felt like there was a, that's number one. Felt like there was a conversation there amongst folks that didn't leave room for that. Secondly, I felt like there was a, although this may not be true, I felt like there was an attack coming at the White Privilege Conference and myself in the work that I was doing, and not in a way that was paying respect to that. And maybe, I mean, I'm not unwilling to deny that some of that's not ego, so I don't want to not factor myself or my ego in that, but that's a problem.
Can you, if you remember, I know it's been a few weeks now, if you remember, what specifically did I say or do that you felt was attacking the work that you do with the White Privilege Conference itself? Uh-oh. Dr. Moore? Uh-oh. I hope we didn't lose him. Dang, I hope, hopefully he will ring back if we drop the call. I'm very curious to get the response. For the folks that have called in, please hang on the line as soon as Dr. Moore comes back in. I have three questions, and then I'm going to open the phone lines up again. The phone line for you all to call in is 347-215-6071. Please call in. And make sure when you call in to ask your question or make your comment, please let us know if you are a white person or a non-white person. Give me 20 seconds. I'm going to double check the switchboard, make sure we get Dr. Moore on so that I can get my last couple questions in, and then I will get to the phone lines. I also wanted to throw in, for anyone who is just listening to this broadcast live on Blog Talk Radio, if the program extends beyond the two-hour mark before this program gets to 5 p.m. Eastern or 2 p.m. Pacific, wherever your time zone is, before this program reaches the two-hour limit, if you press click to talk, you can listen to the remainder of the live broadcast and you won't be cut off. If you don't press click to talk on your computer, when the two-hour mark comes, the live stream will end and you won't be able to hear the remainder of the conversation. But if you click to talk, you'll be able to hear the remainder of the live stream on your computer, or you can just call in. You can call in whether you have a question or not. You can call in and you can listen to the remainder of the program uninterrupted. But I'm going to check and make sure we get Dr. Moore back so we can finish up, and then I will be getting to the phone line.
I'm here. My brother.
Dr. Moore, did we get you back?
Yes, yes. I was here. I heard you. I heard you the whole time. So.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, man. I got disconnected from you.
No apology, sir. Did you hear the last question? Yes, sir. Did you hear the last question?
About what pissed you off?
I wasn't pissed off about what specifically you felt was attacking the White Privilege Conference.
Oh, I didn't hear that. Are we back?
Yes, sir, we're back.
Well, I don't know if I have. I think for me what felt like was attacking the conference was I felt like the things we were doing there at the conference exhibit table were being associated with Tim as if we were making profit for him or through him and the work he was doing and not in an extension or an understanding of what the White Privilege Conference was or was about.
Okay. I remember when I went to the table.
Go ahead, bro. Sorry.
No problem. I remember when I went to the table where you all had the Got Privilege shirts set up. I actually went there because I had no idea if the shirts were connected with Mr. Wise or not. A non-white person asked me if that was connected with Mr. Wise, and I said I didn't know, but I would go ask. So that was my point for coming to the table in the first place, was to come and to ask, you know, who, or what are the shirts connected to? Is that connected to Mr. Wise, or is that something different? So you all were able to give me information on that because I was ignorant about that. I did want to ask, and respectfully, the white female who was at the table, that was actually the person that I was talking to when I first came. I wasn't talking to you directly. I was talking to the white female. Please forgive me because I don't remember her name. I'm a little old. The white female who was at the table, when I was talking to her about the system of white supremacy and the T-shirts, she moved away from me after I talked to her for a little while, and she said that the system of white supremacy produces the privilege that she has as a white woman. And she moved down the table, and she began speaking with another non-white person. This non-white person reported to me that this white female admitted to being a racist. I wanted to know, is this news to you? Did you know that this person is an admitted racist?
No, that's not news to me, because I think most of the white folks I've engaged and examined their consciousness comes from them admitting not only themselves but also all whites are racist, and again admitting it as I did in the sense of being a victim is not an act of racist but a recovering or anti-racist. Now I'm not applying that to her statement because I wasn't there, but knowing that person, I feel like that's what I've had conversations and what I understand what being a racist or anti-racist or recovering racist is, what is the place in which that person exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, now again, I didn't hear that part. This was reported to me, but The person, the non-white person, didn't say that. She said she was a recovering racist or an anti-racist. She said she was an admitted racist. And again, now this comes back to what we said earlier about racism equals white supremacy. So for me, this person is saying I am an admitted racist white supremacist. Got to throw this person, and I'm doing this respectfully, but I feel like this is critical. There are two things I have learned in studying racism, white supremacy. I am very ignorant about pretty much everything, but these are two things that I overstand. Words are critical in discussing and doing effective work to counter racism, white supremacy. The other principle that I have learned, sexual intercourse between non-white people and white people is incorrect under the system of white supremacy, and it should come to a worldwide halt because the non-white person is in a weak position because of the system of white supremacy. They're always being taken advantage of, and it has been my experience that it confuses the non-white person's ability to understand racism, white supremacy. It becomes very personal with how they view white people, very personal with how their inability to be suspicious of all white people. I have seen this consistently. The admitted racist white woman said she was in a sexual relationship with you. Is that correct?
No. Well, she's my girlfriend. I don't know if sexual relationship and girlfriend are synonymous for you, but that's not for me. So I just want to be clear, going back to Dr. Kevorkian. So are you a segregationist?
What do you mean when you say segregationist?
That means that black people should marry black people and white people should marry white people. Like Wallace was talking about, and like other, what I classify as white supremacists, that's what I classify them as saying, is that you shouldn't dirty the race with people of color, that we are supreme, and because of that, we should stay pure blood, so to speak. So that's kind of the language I've heard, like segregationists speak in, where they say black people or white people and non-black and non-white people shouldn't intermarry or have sex or be together.
Mm. Well, I don't use the term segregationist. I am a victim of white supremacy, and my stance is that sexual intercourse between non-white people and white people is incorrect, and I have said it's incorrect because it confuses the non-white person's ability to understand the system of racism, white supremacy. The two easy steps that I give anyone trying to understand why this is incorrect is that a significant number of people say that it is incorrect for two people to be in a sexual relationship where there is an unequal power dynamic, professor, student, employer, employee, guard, inmate. The system of white supremacy is an unequal power dynamic between white people and non-white people. To my knowledge, they even make laws to prohibit sexual intercourse between boss, employer, guard, inmate, teacher, student. Number two would be, under the system of white supremacy, the evidence shows that a lot of white people have practiced white supremacy and engaged in sexual intercourse with non-white people. The evidence shows this. The evidence shows that white people have consistently been able to fool non-white people and to make them think that they are not white supremacists when they actually have been. Under these conditions, as a non-white person, it would be in my best interest to say I'm not going to engage in sexual intercourse with white people until the system of white supremacy has been replaced with justice, just for my personal safety, and it's incorrect. I'm in a lower power position than that white person, and really, critically, it confounds the non-white person's ability to be suspicious of white people. And I really wanted to go back to you earlier and your problems with the definition and saying it doesn't leave a space for the white people who do practice racism but are not conscious that they practice racism. In my view, it is not in the victim of white supremacy's best interest to leave that space for white people. There should be suspicion of all white people. Under these conditions where we are still being mistreated, we really should not be giving the benefit of the doubt to white people in this regard. Now, again, that doesn't mean that I don't talk to white people. I've had 7 white people on my program. I engage with white people on a regular basis. A white person is standing next to me now, I believe. It's just saying that sexual intercourse is incorrect.
Yeah, for me, as I understand the language of white supremacy, that's the language they use, and they've often used. I mean, they had black people working for them. They had black people as their friends, but they didn't believe sexual intercourse should happen. So, I mean, to me, again, I appreciate people being willing to admit that's where they are, but to me, I'm not a segregationist. So I think the product of integration are those kinds of relationships, whether they're athletics, whether they're personal, so on and so forth. So I mean that just could be a place that we may be in disagreement. But I think it's hard. I don't know how a segregationist can accomplish justice. I think that's actually an oxymoron. Someone who believes in segregation and believes in justice. I don't think those two things, for me, and I'll have to think more about this, can go together.
Again, the terms now. I don't know what a segregationist is. Now, I heard your definition. What I am saying is not that non-white people and white people should be separate. I am not aware of non-white people and white people being separate anywhere on the planet. I am, as I said, next to a white person right now. I am with white people all the time. I understand that. Okay.
Go ahead. Are you saying?
What I'm saying is that the sexual intercourse, sex is an incredibly powerful act. It has an impact on the person's mind, body. I mean, it's a huge behavior. It has a huge impact on how a person thinks. And for a non-white person under the system of white supremacy engaging in sexual intercourse with white people, I have seen repeatedly where it has a mega destructive impact on their ability to think critically and honestly about the system of racism, white supremacy. What it ends up doing, that non-white person has an intimately personal connection to white people that impedes their ability to be suspicious of white people, which is needed as long as the system of white supremacy exists. This is a fundamental aspect of countering racism, white supremacy. Basically, what I'm saying, if you've seen the film Monsters Ball, I'm saying it's Monsters Ball every time it happens.
Yeah, I've seen that film. I think, at least my understanding of those who fought for segregation, particularly white supremacists, that were on the brink of seeing separate but equal, in that when you see the interviews and the writings, their main concern were interracial relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So that's their fuel for segregation. So to me, the argument for segregated relationships is synonymous with segregation and segregationist for me. But I also wonder in what you're saying that, and I'll definitely have to give this some more reflection, that you can't really accomplish as a non-white person the goals of justice under a system of white supremacy if you're in sexual relations with a white person. And if I'm paraphrasing or rephrasing that correctly and understanding that correctly, and I think for me, I don't think someone who argues for segregated relationships, interracial or interpersonal kinds of relationships, can accomplish justice for all. I think the wall of I don't know if it's venom or suspicion or resistance or whatever it is that is as a part of that. I mean, you can't accomplish justice in that framework. I don't think. At least I'll have to think more about that. But that's what I'm thinking right now is how can you accomplish justice as a person who believes that people should only be in sexual relationships with the people that they identify. I don't even know if that's what you're saying. Are you saying I guess I kind of put words in your mouth. I don't know if you're saying that non-white folks can have interrelations with non-white folks. We just can't have them or shouldn't have them or can't accomplish what we need to accomplish if we have them with just white folks.
What I'm saying, and it's actually, this is written on my show page, under the system of racism, white supremacy, I do not encourage, condone, or participate in sexual relationships between white people and non-white people. That is exactly, precisely what I'm saying, and I'm saying the reason is because it is incorrect. And I guess since you said you don't know if a person can achieve or establish justice with that point of view, the evidence shows non-white people have not been able to replace white supremacy with justice and engage in sexual intercourse with white people. The evidence shows we have not been able to do it the other way. I'm unaware of non-white people ever taking a stance that this behavior is incorrect, and we will not engage in sexual intercourse with white people as long as the system of white supremacy exists. I'm suggesting perhaps we should try it another way.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I think that's not a strategy or an option that shouldn't be on the table and should be up for a discussion. And I think in the 21st century, I'm all up for having different options on the table. So I'll definitely have to myself give that some thought. But are you saying that you have seen justice accomplished by non-white people who have only had relationships with non-white people?
Oh, I have not seen justice at all. All I have seen is a system of white supremacy, a system of injustice. I'm not saying that if non-white people today said worldwide we're not having sex with white people as long as the system of white supremacy exists, it might not produce justice. It might not produce anything. But what I am saying is that I have seen an incredible amount of evidence that when non-white people engage in sexual intercourse with white people, it always has destructive and adverse impacts on that non-white person's ability to think honestly about racism, white supremacy, and particularly to be suspicious and critical of white people under the system of white supremacy. That is what I have observed every time. It becomes a very personal attachment that non-white people have to white people. They have a white person that they can identify with and that they have to tell themselves, this person cannot be a racist. And once you've done that for one white person, now there got to be passes for other white people. That's what I have observed consistently, and that needs to come to a halt, in my view. Yeah. I could be incorrect, but
I would say as a case point that you are incorrect. For me, I think not only have I been able to continue the work that I'm doing, but I think that actually my level of scrutiny and criticism has risen because of those kinds of experiences have given me a new insight, a new place and new spaces that has helped me to uncover even more reasons to raise the level of suspicion. So, and I think that those on the non-white side that experience that greater level of scrutiny puts them in a position of greater discomfort and a need for greater awareness, because you can't continue it if my level of scrutiny is rising and your level of comfort is subsiding. I mean, you experience a greater level of discomfort and have to bring a greater level of consciousness in order for there to be, I think, a healthy existence. At least my experience, that's my scenario. But I mean, mine may just be one, you know, fluke kind of situation, and it may be, and I'm not unwilling to critically look at this. It may be just a personal desire on my part to find a, you know, kind of soothing lotion so it doesn't feel so painful what it is that you're saying. So I'm not unwilling to look at that, but I just think that I'm going to give that some thought. But I also think, and what I would respectfully ask you and those from your listening audience have the same or similar kinds of viewpoint, that you'd be willing to consider that you can't believe in in any way that a system needs to.
Dr. Moore? Uh-oh, you broke up a little bit. Can you hear us there, Dr. Moore? Dr. Moore? Oh, I think we lost him again. I wanted to hear his thought. It sounded like he was saying something important. Hopefully he'll jingle us right back, because I want to finish that thought. When I bring Dr. Moore back on, I'm going to be bringing on two callers. If you could, ideally, if you could press mute, and I will call out your area code so that you can ask your question or make your comments and all that jazz. Please remember, if you could tell us if you are a white person or a non-white person, that would be fantastic. I'm going to go and see if I can get Dr. Moore, bring him back on so he can finish his very important point, and then I'm going to bring in the callers. Thank you for listening in, and I'll be right back. Dr. Moore, are you back, sir? Dr. Moore? Oh, I thought I had him back on the line. I'll try again. Give me 2 seconds. Let me see if I can get Dr. Moore back.
I'm here. Hello?
Dr. Moore, we got you now.
Yes, sir, I'm back.
Okay. I apologize. You broke up on us. Could you please finish your last thought? Because I definitely want to make sure you're able to share that.
No, I think the last point ended with, again, that question of can justice be accomplished by segregationists?
Okay. We have a couple callers on the line. I wanted to ask really quick before we go to the callers, the white female that is your girlfriend, has she passed your theory of incapability? That is she able to see black people as the scholar and not as a nigger?
No. The theory of incapability is an ongoing process. It's not a pass-fail. It's an adaptation so that every day the work being done helps fight back the nigger syndrome. But it's an ongoing process. So it's not that I ask for a pass. It's asked for an adaptation to the life that you live and the way you live it.
Okay. 414, are you there?
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you? She's in Wisconsin, 414. She's in Wisconsin. She should be at the White Privilege Conference next April. Bell bottoms and counter-racist experiments ready to go.
Yes, I will be attending. I will be. I'm just listening for now.
Oh, okay.
I'll press one when I want to say something. But I was talking to a white person on the board, and I was just listening off and on. So.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you for listening.
You're welcome.
953, I believe. Are you there?
954.
954. I apologize. I'm sorry. 954. Go ahead.
That's okay. You don't have to apologize to me. I am a non-white female by the name of Diva JC. How you doing?
Gee, I'm very well. Thank you for listening, loyal listener. Thank you for listening in.
Yeah, I try to listen every possible time because what you're saying is so important, and I want to say to the doctor that I agree. As a matter of fact, I started talking to the host in the same vein that segregation would not lead to justice. But I also believe in the old adage that if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to get the same results. And I believe that particularly with our musicians and our athletes who reach a pinnacle economically, that they are guided into relationships with people, with white people, so that economic benefit will fall into the bank accounts of white people. Whereas if brothers would marry sisters when they got rich, the money would go into the bank accounts of black people. So this is purely economics. You know, this is economics. Okay. I had another point, but that one stuck with me the most, the economics of, you know, I mean, look at what marrying a white woman did to OJ, you know, look at Kobe Bryant, look at, you know, the whole Yell rape scene. Dr. Welsing said that when black people are involved in an interracial relationship, it is generally brought on by the white person as a seducer. So you have to ask the question, what are they getting out of this relationship? And the other part is what I wanted to say about what you said earlier, is that we will never, ever know what white people are saying when there are no black people around. Just like they will never, ever know what we're saying when they're not around. So I'm going to let you comment on that. And thank you, Victim of Racism, for having these wonderful shows to, you know, talk about this. We have to talk about it. Communicate. Thank you.
Thank you.
man. Just the spirit of that listener and the challenge and the question, but the spirit of it is just, I just feel so humbled. And again, my brother, I just want to thank you for asking me to be a part of this show. I do think that there is some unhealthy teachings and unhealthy behaviors going into the pursuit of whiteness, and that's what white supremacy does, from my understanding, is it produces an unhealthy psychology about beauty and the pursuit of beauty in whiteness, and where you see a lot of these folks from the professional arenas, and which she mentioned, pursuing whiteness as if it is the answer. And I think that that's not the kind of thing that, for me, I'm advocating. And I think that if a person has and continues to be working on a level of consciousness, that the end product of integration is the opportunity to interact, to meet, and possibly have friendships and sexual relationships. That's the product of an integrated society. And so I think that if it comes as a product of that, to me, I'm not in opposition of that. But I do think the point that you raised, my brother, about is it deadly medication to the psychology for a person of color, for a black person to reengage in a sexual relationship with a non-person of color or a white person? That has to be on the table. And I can't think of many other places I've seen it, and I'm glad that I'm engaging with that conversation here, and I will continue to ask myself that, because maybe that's the form of incapability that I myself need to employ as a black man.
Right on. 206.
Hello.
Hello, 206, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me.
Yes, sir.
Oh, wonderful.
I know this voice. 206.
Victim of racism and Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. How are you, sir?
I'm well, sir. Thank you for calling.
Now, knowing that consciousness has called.
Hey. You know, I didn't think I was going to be able to be a part of this, but I've been listening the whole time. Well, just about the whole time. I love the conversation. You know, I've got lots of things to say, Dr. Moore. And victim of racism, you're talking about some heavy subjects, but number one,
non-white person.
Oh, I am a person of my mother is Caucasian, my father is African American. So what does that make me? What does that make me?
Do white people?
I'm sorry.
Do white people think you are white?
When they want to.
Wow. Very interesting. How do you know that they think you are white when they want to?
Well, I mean, obviously I am not white. I mean, if you put me up, against a Scandinavian, and no, I have dark skin, I have curly hair, but I have some, I would say, European features as far as my nose, maybe, and my lips, and... No, but the construct, the European aesthetic is of course looked at differently by different people depending on their perspective. But no, I'm obviously a person of color, yes, sir. But when people want to be comfortable with me, I'm sure white people can look at me as I'm not like.
Dr. Moore,
someone that has a sub-Saharan phenotype.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So, what I wanted to say is what I think is very important is, of course, and you touched on this. You did more than touch on this. You spoke about it in depth. Was our dialogue. The semantics of the words that we use are very, very antiquated. And we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of dialogue like this that needs to happen before we can true, T-R-U-E, our understandings until we're both on the same page. And I'm speaking of the white community and the black community. That those are the two outer ends of the polemic dialogue. And everything else is contained within that bulwark. Now, of course, there are individual stories that need to be considered. But when I speak about the racial dialogue that needs to happen, it's between, it's what, of course, what Dr. Francis Cress Welsing so wonderfully enunciated in her The Isis Papers book, The Color Confrontation Theory. And a very good friend of mine from New York City, Carol Taylor and Lawrence Legall, who have put together racismtest.org, have addressed this issue also. We need to talk about some of these things that are tacitly in the fabric of our institutionalized behaviors that aren't really looked at and need to be exposed and then need to be deconstructed. But it's not going to happen until we talk about it first and then take some of the fear away from the folks that have never really talked about racism. That's what I do on my website, discussrace.com, which I've had online for nearly 5 years. And my own experience with race is really pretty deep, because when I was conceived in 1959, my white mother was engaged to a white man who was in engineering school. And she got pregnant and then realized she had to do something. And my father, the African-American man, was married. He had a wife and 5 kids. She was engaged to a white man who was in engineering school. So she married him 5 months before I was born. And then after I was born, of course, she had to save her marriage and her reputation. So she did what anyone would do that had any kind of sense. She came up with a story to explain my appearance. And the story she came up with was that I had a skin disease. And that's what I was raised being told for many, many, many years in white middle-class America. So my understanding of the race, the construct of race, and how that relates to our communities sociologically is pretty profound, because I've had to live it.
Wow.
And now you know, I don't want to be a grandstander here. I just want to say that I know what it feels like. I mean, Barack Obama, President Obama, and myself are about the same age. I think he was born in 62. I was born in 60. But we had very similar experiences. Now, I know his mother is white, just like mine, and he knew who his father was much younger than I learned who my father was. My mother told me who my mother was in 1986 when I was 26. Now, believe me, my first serious relationship was with an African-American woman when I was 22 and living in California. And she grew up in a middle-class African-American family. Her father, who was actually her stepfather, her mother married him when she was pretty young, was a colonel in the Army, an African-American man, Jasper Horn. And you know what she told me when I told her? Now, the skin disease story was something that I carried in my back pocket. Of course, I went to all white schools, and I pulled that out whenever I needed to. And I learned how, and the term that I know Dr. Eddie Moore is familiar with, the cognitive dissonance that I used to employ to make my existence make sense. As I got older, into my teens, the cognitive dissonance that I had to employ became more operative. I had to, because I started to wake up and realize, hey man, something's not adding up here. But to keep my life sane, I had to not look at certain things. And essentially, people in white society that have some sense and have some awareness as to the socioeconomic disparities that are inherent in our society here. And of course, it's more apparent in certain more areas than other areas. I mean, if you're living in New York City or an urban area, you know, you can tell more so than you can if you're living in Iowa.
Yes, sir.
So
I have another caller, so if you could.
I'll wrap it up. I've got a lot to say, and thank you, sir, for giving me an opportunity. What I would like to say was I hope that we do more of this. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., he does great work, and he's given me an opportunity to be a part of the White Privilege Conference. Please take a look at discussrace.com when you can. I've got a discussion forum. Add your comments. Read some of the books, hundreds of books on my website. We need to read, we need to talk, we need to engage and not be afraid.
Thank you. If you could stay on the line, you can press 1 to put your hand up again. Once I get through some of the calls, then I can go back and get other people to make other comments. And anyone that's on the line, all you have to do is press 1. It'll put your hand up, and I can get you back on. I just want to make sure that I give everybody who called in an opportunity to
yes, sir.
Get a question or comment in. So just hang tight and press 1, and I can get you back on to share more of your views, which I found very interesting.
Thank you.
917, you're on the air.
Hi. This is Jessica Pettit. I actually live in California, but my cell phone lived at one point in time in New York City.
So, hi.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I have been
stirring stuff up in the chat room.
Are you a white person or a non-white person?
I am definitely a white woman.
Okay.
That's not my traffic. I was calling because first of all, thank you for doing the show, and thank you for having Eddie on. I think that the White Privilege Conference is widely misunderstood, and I think that it's a really great way to open up the conversation. I know for myself, as a white person, being able to be in a space with other whites, specifically whites, who are...
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Marjorie. Hello?
David, you got to get off the phone, man, if you're going to... Station, man. You can't be taking your personal calls on the station, bro.
Hello?
Hello? Jessica, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. So for me as a white person, one of the things I was talking about in the chat room is that I very early on identified as a diversity trainer and was not aware of my whiteness having any kind of power or impact on anybody else because I wasn't conscious of it. And so, like, at the very beginning of the conversation, when you were having the conversations about your definition of white supremacist and Eddie's definition, they're very similar in that what I liked about Eddie's definition is that it allows room for me in existence. And in listening to the call today, it seems really important to clarify that I am a racist, and that is a relatively new thing that I have become aware of. So I've gone from being an oblivious blind racist to someone who's conscious and paying attention. And part of paying attention is also understanding the structures and things like that that racism and white supremacy lean on that I have inherited and benefited from since birth. So I definitely see how the words can be used as synonyms, and I also really very much see how there's room for people becoming aware that they are actively playing a role and or navigating a system that's, the more privilege you have, the more invisible the system is. So I wanted to call in and say that, and some of the conversations that I've been having in the chat room it reminded me of something that when I was in the Peace Corps, you can laugh and we can talk about how white woman that is that I was even in the Peace Corps. But when I was teaching English in Bulgaria, a lot of the times my students would ask me, when I would correct their papers, why is it that I know this is incorrect? And I would tell them that I can't tell you why I know what you said is wrong, but I can tell you that it's wrong. And what that had to do with is that I'm a native English speaker, and I'm not a British English speaker. I'm an American English speaker, and when you say something to me, I can tell you that the words are in the wrong order or the intonation of the sentence isn't correct. I don't know why. I just know that it doesn't sound right. And I believe that as a white person in the United States growing up through white supremacy, raised by parents who would very much identify as white, liberal, good people, were active in the civil rights movement, etc., it's like being a native English speaker in the sense that I had never had to challenge the structures of why that was in existence. And then when I took my first grammar class and began to, like, diagram sentences and stuff, I began to understand the system of the language that I just happened to speak. And I learned foreign languages, the same thing happened as well. And I find, as a white person, I'm now learning what that means and that it has an impact on others, whether I'm in the room or not. And the ability to go to a space like the White Privilege Conference and check in with other people who are opting to do the same kind of work is really motivating and powerful, so that I will continue doing the work, because the system that I navigate on a daily basis is so comfortable, I don't have to go against it. So that's where I'm coming as a white person who... it's totally fine saying that I'm a self-identified racist. I definitely benefit from white supremacy, and I actively am trying to do the best I can to dismantle how I use my white privilege. So that's why I called it.
As an admitted racist, have you now ever mistreated someone because they were not white?
I'm positive that I have done it consciously and unconsciously.
Oh, okay.
And I would say that I think that a fuller truth would be that I did it before knowing I was white and have done it since knowing that I was white.
Oh, now wait a minute. We want to be very clear. Before you got this understanding about... I think NTWO God, you're on the air. If you could hold tight, I'm getting to you next. I want to be very clear about this. Before you got the information about racism, white supremacy, and became aware that you're white and what all that means, prior to that, you said that you probably consciously and unconsciously mistreated individuals who are not white. Is that correct?
I would imagine so, but that is probably a truth.
Okay. If that is true, you were consciously practicing racism. That's what I'm saying. White people are able to consciously practice racism, whether they have been to the White Privilege Conference, whether they have a thorough understanding of how racism, white supremacy works at all. Again, if you go back, Farrell Winfrey interview April 1st, probably one of the best interviews I've had with a white person, exclusively talking about white supremacy. The only things a white person needs to know to consciously practice racism: I know I'm white, and I know how to differentiate between a white person and a non-white person. If you know that, you know more than enough to consciously. You know more than enough to consciously practice racism. And I have never met a white person who is, one, unaware that they are white, and unable to tell the difference between a white person and a non-white person. As that stands, I have absolutely no reason at all to think that white people, all white people, are consciously practicing racism, white supremacy, and you just evidenced that by saying you consciously were mistreating people who were not white even before you did the white privilege work.
I don't want to interrupt you. Yes, that is what I said. I think the important add is that by virtue of white supremacy existing, I didn't know that I was white because I didn't have to know that I was white. I was never given a struggle. I was never denied anything. I was never discriminated against anything. And so I could study, observe, pay attention to other kind of things. One of the things we were talking about in the chat room was that race was something I thought other people had. And even now in my own work, I'm frequently dealing with white people who don't understand that they also have a race. Same thing with gender, that most people don't know that they have a gender unless there's some kind of gender problem going on. By coming to a place where I understood what that means, the consciousness level increased. I don't know if that makes any sense. And in listening to you in the last 2 hours, I know words are really important to you.
You too. You study English, correct?
I taught English. I took an English class. I was just using that as the metaphor. But words, I think, and I actually put this in the very beginning of the chat, is that words are the master's tools. And it's language in itself is very, very limiting. And I don't think it's about semantics. I really want to name the truth as a white person, that consciously I may have done things, made assumptions, said things, jumped in front of a person of color in line because I didn't even – I wasn't conscious of that power dynamic, but conscious that I was doing something. And probably it became what I would call an Olympic athlete at coming up with perfectly logical explanations as to why these things were happening. Like one of the things that I frequently say is that this quote-unquote civil rights movement, which I think is a term that white people call the 60s to feel better, I think what it taught us as white people is not that people are equal, but it taught us what to do publicly and what not to do publicly. And that's not always a conscious decision. I think it's just something that's learned. So the consciousness that I feel that I have now as a white person is that even I'm in my house by myself, my whiteness has an impact on my neighbors, people down the street, really understanding the full magnitude of what my inherited privilege gives me and takes from other people is something that I'm not just conscious of now, it's something that I actively keep in my forefront. Because I understand that it might not be my fault that I'm white, or history may not be my fault, but it is definitely my responsibility to do something specifically with the power that I have inherited because it is unjust. And I feel that that's significantly different than just being conscious of it.
I want to snag our next caller in. If you can stay on the line as well, I can come back to get you as well. But I did want to point out one suggestion. You didn't ask for suggestions, but one suggestion I would give to
it's
you.
It's your show.
anyone listening, you're a white person, an admitted racist, white supremacist, I might add. So, you know, it's your show, no pun intended. I would suggest not using the term whiteness. Words are very important. What it does is distance the problem. Robert Jensen, quote him again, Dr. Robert Jensen, his book, The Heart of Whiteness, the problem is white people, specifically white people who practice white supremacy. Using terms like whiteness distances pointing the finger at white people for this problem. This is very important. We don't want to talk about the system of white supremacy as though it is some nebulous force in the universe, in the atmosphere, in the air that is causing these problems. We really want to make sure that we are saying, hey, at the end of the day, it's white people who practice racism that is causing the problem. Your whiteness, quote unquote, in the room is not what we want to address. We want to address you being an admitted racist, white supremacist, and functioning as such, even when you were not aware, you were functioning consciously and unconsciously as a racist, white supremacist. And that's what we want to address. But hang tight. I will definitely bring you back in. I appreciated you sharing. It's NT, oh God, whoever that is, your handle, you're on the air. I believe it's NTWO God or something close to that. I believe you are on Click to Talk. If you want to say anything, feel free. Not interested? Okay. I will get another. If Dr. Moore, if you have comments or responses to anything that you've heard, feel free to give your response. I will snag some of our other callers really quick.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I can say coming in is that I wonder if whiteness can be a product or a existence or a status that extends.
Hello?
Yes, 954, you are on the air. I believe that's Diva JC. She had her hand up. Do you have a comment, question? No? Okay. Jessica Pettit, are you there?
I'm right here. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Did you have another comment or response that you wanted to make?
I'm 917.
917, okay.
Right, Jessica Pettit, 917, that's all me.
Oh,
hi.
Okay. Did you have a comment that you wanted to make? Or
I just spoke, and then it was blank air for a little while.
Oh, okay, okay. Some of the people that have their hand up to speak are not either, I don't know if they don't have a comment anymore or what have you.
I just want to be respectful of the rest of the people on the list, so.
Oh yeah, totally. I do too, but it's kind of a conundrum because they're not saying anything. I will get the brother that Dr. Moore knows. He's still on the air and he has his hand up, so I'll bring him in and he can share his thoughts or comments. I definitely want to check his website out as well. So I'm coming to you right now, sir.
Can you hear me?
I can
hear you.
Hello.
You can hear me. Is this Jessica?
206.
Yes.
You there?
I am. I've been here.
Right on. Go right ahead, sir.
I'm sorry what happened before. I had a call waiting call and I didn't realize that you could hear that. I apologize for disrupting your conversation after our initial conversation. But go ahead, sir. Did you have a question for me?
Oh, I wanted to open up because I know it sounded like you had other thoughts that you wanted to share, and I wanted to give you opportunity to share a little bit more since I lost one of the people that called in. If you had...
Oh, my gosh. I've got lots to say, but I suppose I need to be prompted about... You know, this dialogue that we have earnestly engaged here is, it needs to happen. I mean, that's just a moot point. But the way the egress into someone's heart is different with each person, depending on their particular experience and their comfort levels. So one of the things I believe that needs to happen is we need more education and not this Eurocentric oleo mush that we've been spoon-fed for decades. I know they're doing a little bit better now, and I know with the advent of the internet, if you know what to look for, you can just Google it and you can read it. But a lot of people don't know where to begin. A lot of white folks don't know where to begin. My family that I grew up with, my white mother, bless her heart, my white adoptive father, my four younger white siblings that were born after me to my mother and adoptive father, won't speak to me.
Whoa.
The skin disease story, of course, was something my mother told me when I came home from school the first time in kindergarten, first grade, upset because, you know, some of the other white kids were calling me names. So she gave me a rationalization for it. And, of course, I took it on and I codified it and I made it part of my being, this skin disease story. And so we didn't talk about this as a family unit. It just, race was not discussed. We didn't have to talk about it. We lived in an all-white community. I went to all-white schools. If you read the article that was written about me in the Orlando Sentinel when I kind of broke my story, which happened when I moved to Florida to try to reconnect a dialogue with my folks in late 2001 and realize they weren't ready to talk about it. In 2005, an article titled A Big White Lie was published, and you can just Google it if you put my name in Dave Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, but even if you just Google A Big White Lie, that should bring up the original article. And the man that interviewed me also was able to procure an interview with my mother and adoptive father. I didn't think he'd be able to do it, but he said, hey, what he said to him is, he said, listen, this is going to be published. You might as well put your two cents in. So I guess they thought best that they did. And some of the things they said were news to me as far as what their attitudes were about black folks. And it was illuminating. Now once that article was published, that which was in September of 2005, to just back up just a minute, the first thing I did publicly to air my story was I did a TV interview on a little cable channel in Florida. It was a vision program. Betty Martinez Lowry was the moderator, and it was a half an hour program, and I talked about my experience. Now, I didn't want to be vindictive. I didn't want to be hurtful. I knew there was an opportunity that my mother and adoptive father would get an opportunity to see this. I wanted to encourage our dialogue. But the first time it ran was in April of 2003, I didn't have the courage to let them know, and they didn't see it. The second time it ran, it was in August of 2003. The day before I called home, my dad answered, my adoptive father. I said, Dad, I did this interview about my life. Would you and Mom please watch it and give me a call back and let me know what you think about it? Now, we lived about 75 miles apart, and so it wasn't like we were right next door. And after Sunday afternoon, when they didn't call me back, I knew the gloves were off. And so then the next year in 2004, I met the brother Pete Lawrence, who said, you know, he's from Haiti. He actually grew up in New York. He moved to New York when he was 16. But he said, really, really smart brother. Just got his law degree. He said, David, you know, he came into the tennis club where I was working. He said, you know, are you biracial? I said, blah, blah. We went into the story. He said, we got to get a website online for you. So that was the birth of DiscussRace.com. Now, in researching for that, I said, Pete, I don't want this to just be about my story. I want this to be about what's been perpetrated against black America. And in reading books, and you'll look, I've got a reading list. I've got hundreds of books that you can access book titles from my site that I've read, and I've read them because I wanted to know not just about what's happened since 1865, but I wanted to know why that happened. What I wanted to go to know what happened in Africa. So one of the things I've learned is that, and through reading some of the Afrocentric authors like Shikanta Diop and Dr. Francis Kress Welsing and Chancellor Williams and Naim Akbar and many others, is that, number one, what we live here in America is a fantasy and race that guides our life is a total construct. It's a construct. It's a game that we're playing. And a lot of it has to do with money and capitalism and power. But slavery, not the chattel slavery that was employed in the United States, but slavery, sure, people say slavery's been around. The Arabs enslaved black Africans, you know, starting in the 7th century A.D., there was other types of slavery between tribal factions in Africa herself. What we need to do is we need to understand the etiology of how we have arrived at where we are now. And we need to be able to accurately connect the dots. If there's a disconnect, then you have a problem that my mother and stepfather have. They, my adoptive father, my adoptive father graduated from high school in 57, graduated from college in 61, grew up, they were married when the Civil Rights Act had happened, the voting rights, affirmative action. So in their mind, everything's okay. Why do black people have a problem? Everything's equal. Because they've never been educated as to how this whole mess was put into place, perpetuated. So we need to educate ubiquitously. And we need a program, a government program, where these books are disseminated, where we have accurate information, not this stuff that we're getting that divides and conquers us every time we read it, because it's not accurate for the most part.
Right on. I wanted to ask if you could share your website again with listeners so they could check it out.
It is www.discussrace.com, all one word, DUSCUSSRACE.com. I've got my own story, the Dave Myers story. I also have a discussion forum with about 350 different discussion threads. And I also have something that I published about a year ago, and you can Google it. It's called Born with a Skin Disease, A Mother's Whitewash. At the end of it, I've got 11 questions. And so far, I haven't gotten too many answers to those questions, even when it was published in the Black Commentator, which is kind of the not quite the Washington Post, but it gets quite educated people that contribute to its scholarship.
I definitely want to check out your broadcast. I'm only jumping in here because I definitely want to make sure that I give Dr.
Oh, Warren yeah. I know. I've been talking a long time, and I appreciate you allowing me to.
It has been very interesting. I plan on checking out your website, and if you have contact information there, I will probably be shooting you an email because it's been very interesting. So I definitely
want to
learn more and check out your article as well. I'll probably be doing it today, so look out, it's coming.
All right, right on.
Dr. Moore, I want to give you the opportunity to give the last word here and share any thoughts that you have and any information if you want to give out for people to be able to get more information about the White Privilege Conference or any other of the work that you're doing, things going on at the Bush School or anything else. Please feel free to share with the audience anything. Uh-oh. Did we lose Dr. Moore? Is he here? Oh, that's a shame. My my switchboard is acting a little strange. That's why I couldn't get the other caller on. So if Dr. Moore, if he can hear me, I apologize. My switchboard is not cooperating with me right now, and I can't bring anybody else onto the line to close out. So I give you my sincere apologies because I really wanted you to share your final thoughts on the program and to give out information. The White Privilege Conference, I can tell anybody, if you are listening at Blog Talk Radio, go to the description and click on the link for White Privilege Conference. It'll be in blue. All you have to do is click on that, and it will take you to the website for the White Privilege Conference. All the information you need about it should be right there, including contact information for Dr. Moore. I also have the web address for the Bush School here in Seattle, where Dr. Moore is the Director of Diversity. You can click that link as well. That will give you information on how to contact him at the Bush School in Seattle and see more about what they do there. Again, sincere apologies. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with Dr. Moore. Incredible dialogue, and I look forward to getting him back on the program at some point. And definitely the plan is to be in Wisconsin April 7th through the 10th, 2010, for the White Privilege Conference. The cows should be broadcasting live from the White Privilege Conference next spring. Akima, be there, Wisconsin, everybody from the code.net, counter racism. We should all be making an effort to be in Wisconsin to run our counter racist experiments and to evaluate what these white people are doing who say they want to replace white supremacy with justice. Has been a fantastic program. I thoroughly appreciate everyone who tuned in to listen to the show and to call in. Thank everybody. Again, my apologies to Dr. Moore. He was incredible from the beginning of this week to the end of this week, both when we spoke at the Bush School on Monday, incredibly kind in sharing information with me. And I was loaded up. I felt like Santa Claus leaving. I had a sack full of goodies when I left the Bush School, and he was incredibly gracious to spend so much time with us here today on the program. I thoroughly enjoyed it. He is a gentleman and a scholar to the fullest degree, and I look forward to speaking with him soon. Maybe he'll come back and share some more of his time with us down the road. Please check out the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Again, the admitted white supremacist known as Tim Wise will be here June 1st, 11:30 a.m. Pacific Time, 2:30 p.m. Eastern. Tim Wise will be in the house. That should be a most interesting and constructive conversation. I'm very much looking forward to that dialogue and to hearing what he has to say. I hope it is more challenging than this interview. I'm very much looking forward to speaking with Mr. Wise. I should have two shows next week, one on Wednesday with Dr. Harvey. We'll be discussing the symbolism of black clothing, in particular, white people wearing black clothing for judges, graduation, the whole goth look, the power business black suit. What does that mean in a system of white supremacy? Dr. Harvey, who is a white person, will be here to discuss this. Anybody who really pays close attention to Dr. Welsing's lectures, she mentioned this book in her lecture. So that'll be Wednesday, and there should be another show on Friday. This is all before the Tim Wise program on Monday, June 1st. So again, thank everybody for tuning in, and I definitely wanted to make sure that I rescinded my comment from last week. No, I do not want criticism from listeners, because I've seen people really go nutty with that. If you have questions, if you have comments, that's great, but in terms of criticism, no thanks. I'm not requesting that. If you don't find the show constructive, again, please do not invest your time and energy in something that is non-constructive, because it's my view that non-white people we waste a lot of time, and I don't want to contribute to that effort. If what I'm doing is not constructive, please find something constructive. Don't waste your time here if this is not a productive endeavor. Again, thank you, everybody, for tuning into the broadcast, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. Please check out Mr. Edward Williams at counter-racism.com. Constructive information there. Thank you, Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr. I thoroughly appreciate you spending time with us. Look forward to chatting with everyone soon. Replace white supremacy with justice. Thank you so much, and we'll be at you soon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This was a great talk. I really appreciated it.
Are we still on? Are we? Can we hear one another?
I think
hello?
It might be you and I. I'm not sure. So
okay.
Hi, I'm
Jessica. I'm sorry?
I'm Jessica. It's nice to meet you.